From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we revisit the O.J. Simpson trial nearly a year after the verdict. Jeffrey Toobin says there are several things we know now that we didn't know then. O.J. Simpson failed a lie detector test. Simpson was leaked the verdict before it was delivered in court. Toobin covered the criminal trial for The New Yorker. He chronicles and analyzes the trial in his new book, The Run of His Life. Also, music critic Ken Tucker reviews a recording which sparked a dance craze, and it's not the Macarena. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Defense Secretary William Perry says Iraqi warnings against Kuwait are totally unacceptable. He says U.S. forces in the Persian Gulf will take action if necessary.
They have very, what we call, robust rules of engagement. So everybody should understand that the United States will take all necessary and appropriate action to protect our forces and to protect our interests in that area.
Perry spoke after Iraq's deputy prime minister warned Kuwait against letting U.S. warplanes use Kuwaiti bases for possible military strikes against Iraq. Meanwhile, Iraqi television is reporting Iraqi air defense units fired three missiles at U.S. and allied warplanes patrolling the expanded no-fly zone in southern Iraq. The Pentagon says these reports are completely unfounded. Relief workers are leaving northern Iraq for Turkey and Iran. They've been threatened by Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. The State Department says several thousand people are considered at risk because of their ties to the United States and its allies. The BBC's Margaret Gilmore reports from northern Iraq.
The charities are concerned that heightened tensions between Saddam Hussein and the West are making their job increasingly dangerous. This morning, American aid workers here in Sulaymaniyah packed up and headed for the border with Turkey in a convoy. They fear anti-American reprisals if the U.S. attacks Iraq. At the same time, many local Kurdish staff have also fled, amongst them workers with Save the Children UK. They've taken their families to the Iranian border, where they're working to ease the plight of several thousand refugees, but are too frightened to return. They're worried by a statement from Saddam Hussein in the Baghdad newspapers today, in which he grants freedom of movement throughout all Iraq to the Kurds, but excludes those working for Western organizations.
Margaret Gilmore reporting. Hurricane Hortense is passing the Bahamas this morning. There are reports of some power outages, but no deaths or injuries. The National Hurricane Center says Hortense is now a Category 3 storm with winds clocked at 115 miles per hour. Forecaster Fiona Horsfall says U.S. coastal residents don't have to worry about the storm as much as Canadians do.
We do not anticipate putting watches up at this time for the East Coast at all. It'll be Canada, more than likely, that'll be putting advisories out for the Nova Scotia region.
Heavy surf associated with the storm is expected to reach southeastern U.S. shores by tomorrow. The Federal Trade Commission has approved Time Warner's $6.5 billion purchase of Turner Broadcasting Systems. The vote was narrowly divided. Approval had been seen as assured after a July agreement between the FTC and the parties to limit the influence of major shareholder Telecommunications Incorporated. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 31 points. This is NPR. Machinists striking the aerospace firm McDonnell Douglas have voted to go back to work. From member station KWMU, Lester Graham reports on the end of the 99-day strike.
By a 2-to-1 margin, the 6,700 machinists at McDonnell Douglas plants in St. Louis voted to end the strike. It's a nearly 5-year deal which addresses some of the union concerns about outsourcing and job security. Machinist Ricky Catchens voted for the contract.
Some concessions was made. I think the basic lifetime of contract is good for us and the company, I hope.
McDonnell Douglas spokesperson Tom Williams says it's a good sign union members overwhelmingly approved the contract.
I'm very pleased that that margin is what it is because I think that'll help us get together real quickly and get everything behind us, and that's important to us.
Some workers with less seniority are still concerned they'll leave the picket lines only to be laid off, but the company says it's calling all its union workers back. For National Public Radio, this is Lester Graham in St. Louis.
Automaker Isuzu and Consumer Reports magazine are fighting over the Isuzu Trooper. The magazine alleged that late-model Troopers and Acura SLXs were dangerously unstable and prone to tipping over in sharp turns. The report came out about 3 weeks ago, and since then, sales of those cars have dropped. Both sides have fired off angry letters to each other, and lawyers have been called in. Isuzu rebutted the magazine's charges, releasing results of an in-house engineering study. A spokesman says Isuzu plans no recalls of the sport utility vehicles. The National Commission on Teaching and America's Future says new teachers must be paid more and must be developed. The group says, as things stand now, more than 40 states hire teachers who don't meet basic requirements. More than 12% of new teachers begin with no training at all, and only 500 of the nation's 1,200 education schools meet professional standards. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. O.J. Simpson's civil trial is scheduled to start next week. We're nearing the one-year anniversary of his not guilty verdict in the criminal trial. My guest Jeffrey Toobin covered the trial for The New Yorker. He broke the story that the defense team's strategy would be to portray Mark Furman as a racist rogue cop who framed Simpson. Toobin's new book, The Run of His Life, is a chronicle and analysis of the trial, which includes new revelations. Jeffrey Toobin practiced law before becoming a journalist. He was assistant counsel to Special Prosecutor Lawrence Walsh in the trial of Oliver North. Toobin writes that defense team lawyers Robert Shapiro and Johnny Cochran both thought that Simpson was guilty. I asked Toobin where he got that information.
Well, one of the sort of good things about covering a case for a long time and really sort of steeping yourself in it is you not only get to know the principals, you get to know the friends of the principals, the second and third level players. And I spoke to a lot of people who are good friends of Cochran and Shapiro and all the other people in this case. And several of them, more than two for each person, told me that Cochran and Shapiro confided that they believed he was guilty. Which, I might add, is the only reasonable conclusion anyone can reach from this case. And shouldn't bar them from being the lawyers in the case. I mean, I don't suggest that and I don't believe it.
You do think, though, that they played the race card because that was the only way they could think of to defend a guilty client.
Absolutely. I think from the very beginning, to a degree I didn't even realize when I started researching the book, Shapiro in particular recognized that Los Angeles was such a polarized city and the wounds of Rodney King were so fresh. The way to make this case work for the defense was to create this whole separate narrative of O.J. Simpson as another victim of the LAPD, and that's just what he did.
You were the first reporter to find out that the defense planned on building the case around charges of racism and that they were going to bring Mark Furman into it and accuse him of being a racist rogue cop who framed O.J. How did you first hear about Mark Furman?
Well, it was sort of a circuitous route, and briefly, I graduated from Harvard Law School 10 years ago, and my criminal law professor was Alan Dershowitz. And I knew him a little bit, you know, not especially well. But when my editor, Tina Brown, told me to start working on the case, I called him up and I sort of said, hey, what's up with this? What's going to be interesting and important as the case evolved? And in the course of a rambling conversation, he said that he thought there were real problems with this detective, Mark Furman, who had appeared in the preliminary hearing but not been especially dramatic or important a witness. I then was sent to Los Angeles with a vague mission of finding something interesting that other people weren't reporting. And I knew from my sort of background as a prosecutor that cops were sometimes sued for civil rights violations, and I thought maybe there was something to what Dershowitz was saying. Maybe Furman had been convicted or, that is, found liable for some civil rights violations. So I sort of burrowed off in the Los Angeles Superior Court records. And I did not find what I was looking for, but I found something else. Furman hadn't been sued, but he had sued the city of Los Angeles pension system and asked for a pension. And I thought, and I saw that the grounds for his pension were that he had become such a racist that he felt he was unfit to serve. And I thought this was rather startling information, but even then I didn't really know what, if anything, the defense was going to do with this. So I sort of showed up at Robert Shapiro's door and in Century City and presented myself and said, you know, I've been reading these reading these files, I wondered, you know, first of all, if you knew about them, and second, if you plan to know, plan to do anything. And he said something to me I'll never forget as I was sitting in his office. He said, you know, I want to work with you. I want to work with you. He wanted this story out in the worst way.
Why?
Well, because as I now have reconstructed it, he wanted to present the O.J. Simpson case as the son of Rodney King. He wanted a racist rogue cop at the center of this case. And he said to me, he's a bad cop, he's a racist cop. And then he presented for the first time the scenario of Furman having planted evidence at O.J. Simpson's home. And I reported that, and many things flowed from that, including Shapiro's increasing alienation from his own cause, his own, I thought, inappropriate attempt to distance himself from the defense that he himself had started.
You mean like when Shapiro said that Johnny Cochran dealt the race card from the bottom of the deck?
That Shapiro had started
the whole race card defense himself?
Exactly. And I think Johnny Cochran, say what you will, at least had the integrity to stand by what he had done all along and had been consistent and honorable about how he went about defending the case. Shapiro, I thought, was really inappropriate in sort of distancing himself from what he'd started.
Now, when your article came out in The New Yorker about Mark Furman breaking this idea that they were going to say that Furman planted the glove because he was a racist cop who wanted to frame O.J., some people thought that you were being used by the defense with this story.
You know, I certainly heard that. And, you know, my reaction to that was several things. First of all, you know, in my career in journalism, I would say of the people I interview, the approximate percentage of the people who have some agenda with me is 100%.
I mean,
right. Everybody is you know, has some agenda, and I view that as no disqualification to interviewing them and hearing their story. I think what you do if you're trying to do journalism the right way is you put what they say in context, explain their agenda as best you can understand it, and if you look back at what I wrote in The New Yorker in July of 1994, I think it's very clear that I see just what the defense is doing. And in fact, you know, not to toot my own horn here, I think it's rather prescient in terms of how central race would become as a part of this defense. So, you know, my goal, and I'm, you know, not ashamed of this, is you know, I want to be first when I'm a journalist, and I want to break stories. And I did break that story, but I also, I think, put it in the appropriate context, and I think I turned out to be right.
Now, you say you found out that when Robert Shapiro read your story in The New Yorker, he called F. Lee Bailey and said, "It's over, we won the case." How did you find out about that, and how do you feel about that response?
Well, I don't really want to go into how I found out about it, but I you know, it's somewhat discomforting as a journalist, I have to say, when you see how nakedly some people go about peddling their stories. But you know, it was going to be out there. It was going to be a big part of the case in any circumstances. So I had no regrets. But I think it's a revealing part of a theme of both my book and this case of how much the press was a part of the story.
Now, do you think that the defense was unethical in its use of the race card or just playing by the rules to great advantage?
Boy, I wish I had a short answer to that question that was satisfactory to you and to me. You know, I was a prosecutor. I worked in the criminal justice system basically my entire career. And I think that criminal defense lawyers have to be extremely aggressive in challenging everything that the government does and says in a courtroom. And I think the defense in this case was absolutely right to challenge the prosecution's timeline, when events could have taken place, to challenge their collection of DNA evidence. But does that extend to creating an entire separate narrative of events that accused individual cops of racism, of criminal conduct in planting evidence, of really dividing a city intentionally in order to win the acquittal of someone you believe to be guilty yourself? That's a hard question. I don't pretend to have an answer. Maybe it's okay, but I think it's a hard one.
My guest is Jeffrey Toobin. He covered the O.J. Simpson trial for The New Yorker. He's written a new book about the trial called The Run of His Life. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Jeffrey Toobin is my guest, and he covered the O.J. trial for The New Yorker. Now he has a new book called The Run of His Life, The People versus O.J. Simpson. You think that the prosecution lost in part because of Marcia Clark's arrogance and Christopher Darden's ineptitude. Let's start with Marcia Clark. Now, this first thing isn't on the subject of arrogance, but I was astonished to read in your book that she'd never heard of O.J. Simpson when she took the case, not through football, not through commercials, not through his movies.
You know, for all that Marcia Clark is now one of the best-known women in America, she had led a very sort of narrowly circumscribed life up to the time of this trial. You know, she had her friends and she had her work, and she was very far from the L.A. Hollywood scene. She wasn't interested in sports. And that's really the only place you would have heard of O.J. Simpson. And she really was someone who was passionately devoted to her work, had a small circle of friends, and you know, I guess having explored her life a little bit, it's not surprising to me that she'd never heard of him.
Last week, you had a piece in The New Yorker, which is excerpted from your new book, about how Marcia Clark rejected the advice of a jury consultant named Donald Vinson, who was brought in for the case, and how she maybe lost the case as soon as the jury was chosen because she ignored this advice. Marcia Clark, you write, thought that she had a very special rapport with African-American women, and she wanted a lot of black women on the jury. Why did she think she had this rapport?
Well, you know, Marcia Clark had been a very successful prosecutor in that office, and she tried a lot of interesting, complicated homicide cases. And she had a number of black jurors, black women jurors, who not only, you know, voted her way, but who had a fan club of sorts for her, who really identified with her, bonded with her. And for the most part, prosecutors, when they pick juries, go with their gut, go with, you know, their instincts about who's going to identify with them in their case. And she, I have to say, in part to her credit, really thought that what would matter most in the Simpson case was the overwhelming evidence and the real tragedy of Simpson's continuing violence towards his wife, Nicole, and she thought that women would identify with that. The prosecution here had an unusual situation where they had a jury consultant who got involved in the case, and unlike many prosecutors, jury consultants are the ultimate cynics of the legal profession. They are the people who tell you, look, evidence doesn't matter as much as the ethnicity of your jury, as the preconceptions the jurors bring into the courtroom. And she rebelled against this cynicism, and she had a somewhat more idealistic approach. And the jury consultant, Don Vinson, laid out in considerable detail the really remarkable findings of how hostile black women were to Marcia Clark, but even more remarkably, how hostile they were to Nicole Brown Simpson, who'd done nothing but get murdered. And Marcia had to make up her mind which way to go, as be an idealist, be a cynic. She was an idealist, and I think she paid the price.
Well, what did the jury consultant specifically find about African-American women's reaction to O.J. Simpson and to Marcia Clark? And this was based on mock trials and mock juries that he'd set up and phone polls and other surveys, I believe.
Yeah, this is a part of my book and a part of this whole story that I really find among the most heartbreaking and upsetting parts because, you know, everything I believe or want to believe about the legal system suggests that, you know, we should view people as individuals and not as members of groups and that the evidence is what really matters in a trial. But what was so shocking about Vinson's findings is that he found that black women had this real instinctive, passionate identification with O.J. Simpson. And they really admired him in spite of all that came out, even in the early days after the trial, in spite of his domestic violence. And most remarkable of all, they were particularly unimpressed by evidence of domestic violence. You know, Vincent, in his focus groups, heard things like, well, there's always a lot of trouble in marriage. You have to expect these things. These things happen. So there was this real unwillingness to see that domestic violence was an important part of this case. And Marcia Clark in particular was seen by these women as someone who was harsh, overbearing, a bitch. And this is not something Marcia Clark had ever heard before from black women, and she chose to ignore it. But I think the jurors who ultimately sat on this case felt very much like those who sat in Vincent's mock juries.
Was there other advice from the jury consultant that Marcia Clark rejected that you think if she had taken that advice, it would have helped her on the trial?
Well, I think the advice was to play down the domestic violence and perhaps to try this case more in sorrow than in anger, in disappointment rather than a sense of vengeance. And, you know, again, I can see Marcia Clark's perspective. You know, this is a woman who believed that O.J. Simpson had taken a 6-inch knife and slit the throat of the mother of his two children while they slept upstairs, not to mention killing poor Ron Goldman, who showed up on the scene. She was passionate. She was angry. And it's hard not to see how you'd react that way. But that passion and anger really did alienate those jurors. So, again, it seemed like the cynic was right.
We have some information on the makeup of the jury that's very interesting. And this is the jury that finally came in with the verdict, you know, all the members who actually delivered the verdict. Not one member of the jury read a newspaper regularly. 8 members watched TV tabloid news shows like Hard Copy on a regular basis. And again, getting back to the jury consultant, he found polling data that showed a correlation between watching tabloids and believing O.J. was innocent. The people who watch tabloids tend to believe in O.J.'s innocence. 5 members of the jury thought that using physical force on a family member was sometimes justified. 9 members of the jury thought that O.J. was unlikely to have committed murder because he excelled at football.
This just shows the remarkable esteem Simpson was held in by these jurors. It's so chilling and fascinating to me that, I mean, one of the things that, I mean, just one of the many issues that grows out of this, I found particularly striking this business that if you watch tabloids, you're more likely to think O.J. was innocent. This, remember, at a time when the tabloids were beating the hell out of O.J. Simpson and talking about all the terrible things he'd done in his life, yet the fact that there had been all this pretrial publicity didn't hurt Simpson at all. The attention he got, the more he became a symbol, the more he became sort of identified as sort of the most high-profile black defendant perhaps in the history of the American judicial system, the more black jurors, especially black women, rallied to his cause.
Now, just to explain all the information that I just read, that came from a poll of the jury pool that was taken as part of the voir dire?
Right. What happened was both the prosecution and defense gave questions to Judge Ito that they wanted the jury to answer as part of the voir dire process, the jury selection process. So this was a very long document, and it was highly unusual that these lawyers had so much information about these jurors at a time when they made a decision about whom to keep and whom to reject.
Let's get to Christopher Darden. You describe him. One of the kinder things you say is that he's not a talented trial lawyer.
You know, I have to say, one of the parts of this book that I found most fun to investigate is to sort of trace back the relationship between Chris Darden and Johnny Cochran, because it really is sort of a saga of both Los Angeles and African-American life. I mean, both families, the Darden family started out in Texas, and Johnny Cochran's family started out in Louisiana. And right around the time of World War II, there was an enormous migration of black folks from those two states to California, just as people in Mississippi went to Chicago. They came west to work in the great factories established by World War II. But and they both came right to the Bay Area and lived within a few miles of each other. But what's interesting is how different the families were. Cochran's family was middle class and almost upper middle class. His father was an executive with a black-owned insurance company. Chris Darden's family was pretty poor and remained pretty poor his whole life. And the class difference between the two was something that really played out throughout the trial.
How?
You had Cochran, who has the enormous self-confidence and self-possession, and knew how to manipulate Darden, who was much more insecure, much more immature, and simply not as talented a lawyer. So Johnny would pick on Darden, and it was almost painful to watch because, a more self-confident person would have seen how Cochran was manipulating him and would have sort of brushed it off or fired right back. But instead, Darden would roll his eyes and turn his chair away and ruffle his eyes. It was just so pathetic to watch. And, I think the roots of that relationship go back very far.
Jeffrey Toobin covered the O.J. Simpson trial for The New Yorker. His new book about the trial is called The Run of His Life. Toobin will be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how O.J. Simpson's celebrity status affected his trial. We continue our conversation with Jeffrey Toobin, who covered the trial for The New Yorker. Also, music critic Ken Tucker looks at the latest dance craze, and it's not the Macarena. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Back with more of our interview with Jeffrey Toobin. He covered the O.J. Simpson trial for The New Yorker. He chronicles and analyzes the trial in his new book, The Run of His Life. You write about Christopher Darden's on-the-spot decision to have O.J. Simpson try on the glove, in spite of the fact that he had agreed earlier with the other members of the prosecution team not to do it. They thought it wasn't worth the risk. They suspected the glove wouldn't fit. Why did they think it wouldn't fit?
Well, if there was ever an idea that was destined for catastrophe, it was this whole glove demonstration. One of the cardinal rules of being a trial lawyer of any kind is you never ask a question to which you don't know the answer. And another rule is jurors remember what they see a lot more than what they hear. So if you are going to show the jury anything, you always want to make sure that you have rehearsed it, you've discussed it, you've talked about it. And this demonstration violated both of these rules. And remember, Marcia Clark and Bill Hodgman, who was sort of the trial supervisor of the case, they knew this, and they told Darden that very day, let's not do this, because he was wearing rubber gloves. They didn't know if the glove had shrunk. Most of all, they knew that O.J. Simpson would be controlling this experiment himself. And as I tried myself to do in the course of researching this book, it's pretty easy to make a glove that does fit seem like it doesn't fit. So for all those reasons, it was a catastrophe.
But why did Darden decide to go ahead and do it?
Well, what happened was, and this was sort of summed up a lot of, you know, Darden's problems as a prosecutor. F. Lee Bailey was at the sidebar with him, and they were walking away together, and there was some discussion of the glove at the sidebar, and Bailey whispered to him, you know, you have the balls of a stud field mouse if you don't put those gloves on him. If you don't, we will. And instead of just sitting back, recognizing that this was just a lot of sort of manly posturing by F. Lee Bailey, at which he excels, Darden, without talking to Marcia Clark, without even discussing it with his witness, who had no idea this was going to happen, asked for the demonstration. And it was, to put it mildly, an unsuccessful effort in court.
You argue that Christopher Darden also made a big mistake when he argued that the word nigger should not be allowed to be used in the court. Why don't you explain your problem with that?
Well, I was very sympathetic to Chris Darden's situation in this trial. I mean, here was a guy who, by any standard, is a decent human being, forced month after month to answer the accusation from Johnny Cochran, in essence, that he was an Uncle Tom, which is an outrageous, unfair thing for him to have to do. So, you know, it was a terrible situation for him to be in. And when the issue arose early in the trial, whether Mark Furman could be cross-examined about his use of the word nigger, Darden, you know, got up and talked about how ugly this word was, you know, all of which we know, and I think all that everyone agrees with. But he went over the top. He made it seem like the moment this word was said in the courtroom, the jurors would shut off their critical facilities and simply vote to acquit. Now, I think that was, you know, overstating the case. It just didn't make any sense. And it was also, I think, characteristic of his lack of ability to modulate his reactions in court. And Cochran, once again, exploited it very, very successfully.
Well, I think the case you're making there, too, is by Darden making the argument of what a horrible experience it is for any African-American to hear that word. He made the use of that word, and Furman's use of that word seemed even more powerful, more dangerous, more offensive.
It became something like a self-fulfilling prophecy because, you know, it set off this dispute, this debate everywhere about, you know, how bad is the word nigger. And, you know, once you start a dispute like that, it's a one-way ratchet. You can only make it seem worse.
Jeffrey Toobin is my guest. He covered the Simpson trial for The New Yorker. Now Toobin has a new book called The Run of His Life, The People versus O.J. Simpson. The defense tried to prove that there was a police conspiracy against O.J. Simpson. You write that the only conspiracy in the LAPD was to downplay O.J.'s problems. An example that you give is when Nicole Simpson called the police in 1989. What happened?
Well, one of the real tragedies, I thought, of this trial was the way we saw celebrities manipulate the judicial system, not so much as much in the Simpson murder trial as in the 1989 incident. And here you had a situation where Nicole Brown Simpson called the police on January 1st, 1989, bruised, battered, with the outline of a human hand on her neck, wearing a bra and sweatpants, staggering out of the bushes from her house. And the police arrive, and instead of arresting O.J. Simpson on the spot, they treat him very deferentially. They allow him to return to his house. He says this is a family matter. He says, very revealingly, that you guys have been out here 8 times before and you'd never done anything, something that Nicole said to the police separately, indicating that he'd gotten away with this before. And then, in the most remarkable sort of anticipation of the famous car chase of 5 years later, Simpson gets into his car and drives off with the police just standing there. So you saw this deference to Simpson in 1989, but it actually got worse. After that incident, several officers, friends of OJ's, tried to persuade Nicole Brown Simpson not to file charges in the 89 incident. And it made me feel so sad for this woman who, rich as she was really very much alone. And the most haunting echo of that was on June 6, 1994, 6 days before she's murdered, Nicole Brown Simpson called a battered women's shelter, a public, charitable battered women's shelter in Santa Monica, asking for help because she was being stalked by her ex-husband. You know, here, this wealthy woman with her Ferrari had nowhere else to turn but a battered women's shelter because she knew that the police were so much in OJ's corner. And that, to me, is really one of the most haunting images of the whole trial.
You also contradict the idea that there was a police conspiracy against Simpson by saying that Detectives Philip Van Atter and Tom Lang blew the questioning of O.J. Simpson. They went so easy on him.
It's funny how the media sort of takes on a story and there becomes sort of a narrative that's always discussed when, if you look behind it, it sometimes misses the point completely. Howard Weitzman was Simpson's lawyer on that first day, and he received endless criticism for allowing O.J. to talk to the police as if he, you know, could really do anything about it. And it missed the point of what was actually said in the interview. It was one of the most feeble interrogations that in a murder case that's probably ever been conducted. They examined him for 33 minutes. And in my book, I examine the transcript. He is not forced to account for his whereabouts. He's not pressed for any information about what he did the previous night, how he cut his hand, where his clothes are, what the sequence of events was. He is so vague and so nonsensical that his defense was free to construct whatever defense they wanted. The point of an interrogation is to pin someone down. But in their pathetically brief 33-minute interrogation, Simpson just led those detectives around the primrose path.
My guest is Jeffrey Toobin. He covered the Simpson trial for The New Yorker. He's written a new book about the trial called The Run of His Life. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Jeffrey Toobin is my guest. He covered the O.J. Simpson trial for The New Yorker, and now he's written a new book called The Run of His Life, The People versus O.J. Simpson. And you write that O.J. Simpson really wanted Jerry Spence to be his lawyer, and he wasn't sure about Johnny Cochran. You say that O.J. Simpson is the only person in the defense who really didn't understand the nature of race in the case.
I mean, I think that's sort of one of the rich ironies of this case, that, you know, here you had a case that turned into, for better or worse, a sort of civil rights drama over, you know, the role of the police and the attitudes of African Americans towards the judicial system. And that was a very central part of the defense that Robert Shapiro constructed from the very beginning. Yet the only person who didn't understand that was O.J. Simpson, because, it seems, he was so alienated from the African American community, had no contact with it. I mean, you go back to the suicide note. I went and looked at all the people he named, and of the 15 people he thanks as his friends, 14 of them are middle-aged, wealthy white men. Now that's fine. He's welcome to be friends with whoever he likes. But you know, to then claim that you're some sort of civil rights symbol, I don't think you can have it both ways.
You say O.J. Simpson actually knew the verdict in advance of the jury delivering it. How did he find out?
Well, again, this is one of these crazy, crazy situations where the jury, if you recall the chronology, on Monday, October 2nd, reached its verdict and placed it in an envelope and left it with the court. They then returned to the Intercontinental Hotel, which is where they had been sequestered for 9 months. Now, over the course of 9 months, they'd made a lot of friendships, including with the alternates, who were not in on the deliberations, and with the sheriff's deputies, who were guarding them. They had a party that night. People had a few drinks. Tongues were loosened. You can understand the curiosity of both the guards and the alternates, and they said, hey, you know, what happened? And one of the jurors said, for not guilty. What I'm sure this juror didn't know is that the same sheriff's department also ran the jail where Simpson was. One of the deputies called over to one of his colleagues who was guarding Simpson and said, hey, the word is in. He's walking. Simpson, again, in a reflection of how a celebrity is treated differently, had actually become friendly with these people who were guarding him. And in fact, even today, continues to socialize with these sheriff's deputies. One of these deputies said to him, I want your autograph tonight because you're out of here tomorrow. We heard from our guys guarding the jury. Simpson took that information and went to court.
I suppose you couldn't tell us how you found this out.
Well, I mean, again, I can tell you that I had sources on this both at the hotel and at the jail. So I sort of have it from both sides.
Mm-hmm. What are your conclusions about the case?
I used to talk with my friends in the press room, and we used to sort of speculate, how can this story get any worse? How can this get any darker, more divisive, more uglier? And I just feel that this case has nothing but sour and unfortunate messages about our country and our judicial system. I think, you know, it shows how differently blacks and whites perceive the same reality. It shows how, with the right cynical manipulation of those feelings, a celebrity can get away with murder. And I wish I could draw some more elevating lesson from this. But I think the more you look at this case, the worse it gets.
And you're convinced that Simpson got away with murder. You're convinced he's guilty.
Absolutely. I mean, I just, you know, I don't say that with any great joy. I didn't come into this thinking that he was guilty. In many ways, as a journalist, as you know, the most sensational thing I could say to you is, you know, I have found the true killer and I have solved the mystery. But there's no mystery here. All the evidence points to one man. Everyone involved with this case understood the reality about it. And you know, one of my rules as a prosecutor in my own career was, you know, the simplest explanation is always the true one. And, you know, when his blood is there, when he's beaten her up in the past, when he has a motive, when he has the opportunity, when there's evidence against him, that means he's guilty.
Because race was such an issue in this case, and because race is such a sensitive issue, did you have to be very careful when choosing what language to use in writing about the case so that you wouldn't end up getting misinterpreted by readers or cast things in a light that you didn't mean to cast things in?
I found the experience of writing about race as a white person just terribly difficult, and I, you know, always felt like I was treading on very dangerous territory, and I think many of my colleagues did too, and I think in fact, much as, you know, I'm not a great fan of the term political correctness, I think the press really did bend over backwards to avoid giving offense to the African-American community. If you recall the famous cover of Time magazine, where the cover was darkened somewhat in Simpson's picture, and the, you know, people criticized Time so terribly for doing something that I don't think was so terrible and don't think so to this day. But I think that was a shot across the bow very early in this case, that the ideological police were going to be very carefully monitoring white journalists in this enterprise. And I think to the extent we pulled our punches, and I think some of us did, and I think I did at times, I think we misled people about just how overwhelming this case was.
You say it was very difficult to write about this trial as a white person. Give me a sense of what made it difficult, or an example of what was particularly difficult for you.
You may recall there was a witness by the name of Robert Heitstra, who was a car detailer, that's sort of a car washer in the neighborhood where Nicole Brown Simpson was murdered and where she lived. And Christopher Darden was cross-examining him during the course of the defense case and about some prior statements he made. And he said, "Isn't it true, Mr. Heitstra, that you said one of the voices sounded black?" And Johnny Cochran vaulted out of his seat and said, "That's racist. That's terrible. There's no such thing as sounding black. You know, that just shows that, you know, this is a racist prosecution. We shouldn't have to listen to this thing in 1995. And I'm sitting there thinking, well, you know, I think you can tell sometimes, not perfectly, whether someone sounds black or not. Now, does that make me a racist? Does that make Chris Darden a racist for asking the question? Or Robert Heistra a racist for having said it previously? How do you deal with the question of the issue of sounds black? You know, in my book, you know, I chose candor. I said that I thought, you know, it was ridiculous and it was very cynical of Cochran to exploit this moment in this way. But I thought that was a typical example of, you know, how you're always checking yourself and trying to do the right thing when the issue of race comes along.
During the O.J. Simpson trial, you were on a lot of TV shows. It was part of, like, your daily routine, probably. Just to go on TV shows and mull over what had happened that day in the trial. What was that experience like for you? And were there times when it just kind of, like, veered into absurdity for you?
Well, one of the things I have to say, when the jury came back, after deliberating over this case for 2 hours, mm-hmm. you know, I'd be on the Today Show or on Larry King Live and, you know, picking over each day's testimony. You know, that question helped the defense, that question helped the prosecution. And, you know, when the jury just blew the whole thing off, I mean, you know, the 12 people who discussed the O.J. Simpson case least in the entire United States were the 12 people on this jury. I did feel sort of ridiculous that you know, all this parsing of the evidence was ultimately meaningless to the jury. I mean, just on a personal level. I mean, it was fun for me. I am a print journalist. I hope to remain a print journalist forever. But it's interesting. Once you get on television, people really start to pay a lot more attention to you. And, you know, I was the first journalist to be allowed to go into the murder scene and to sort of walk around right where it happened. And I am certain the only reason the woman who had the keys let me in is because she saw me on Larry King.
Right.
and, you know, that's just a fact of modern life, I guess.
Briefly, Judge Ito, how do you think he handled the case? And do you think what a lot of people saw as his lack of control affected the outcome of the trial?
A short story. He invited me back to chambers, like he invited a lot of journalists, to meet him, say hello. Making small talk, I said to him, you know, God, you have a tough job here. And he turned to me and he said, you want to see something? I said, sure, Judge. He said, want to see something great? And he reached behind his desk and he brought out an envelope that had cardboard backing. And it was a letter to him, and it said in substance, "Dear Judge Ito, I think you're doing a wonderful job. Sincerely, Arsenio Hall." And the judge was just blown away by this. He thought this was so great. And I was thinking, boy, this is weird, these judges in Los Angeles. I mean, this was just a starstruck man. And he's a good judge. He's an intelligent man, and his rulings were by and large correct. But I thought he let the phenomenon of the Simpson case take over that courtroom, and that lack of discipline really reflected badly on him and, unfortunately, on the system as a whole.
Would the outcome, do you think, have been different if he had had more control?
Probably not. But I think people would be somewhat less angry about the whole national experience of the trial if it had been a more dignified enterprise.
Jeffrey Toobin, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
Jeffrey Toobin covered the O.J. Simpson trial for The New Yorker. His new book about the trial is called The Run of His Life. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker on the record behind a new dance craze. This is Fresh Air. While everyone else is doing the Macarena, rock critic Ken Tucker is doing the Train. That's the new dance hit by a Florida-based group, the Quad City DJs, that Ken says was the real novelty hit of the summer. And its popularity is continuing into the fall.
Hey, remember the summer? Remember it seemed like everywhere you looked, little knots of people were doing the Macarena, that insidiously simple tune that already seems as overplayed as Stairway to Heaven? Well, hot on its heels, and a much hotter, funnier piece of music to boot, is Come On and Ride It, which has dancers all over the country forming a locomotive conga line, reaching up in the air to pull imaginary train whistles and yelling, toot toot. Sort of hip-hop soul train, Come On and Ride It is the creation of Quad City DJs, a staple of the Florida disco scene. The group is led by the producer and bass player Johnny McGowan, who was also behind 1993's definitive summer junk hit, Woot, There It Is. McGowan specializes in slinky grooves with yelled refrains that turn into chanted pop mantras. For Quad City DJs, McGowan has enlisted the aid of vocalist Jelana LaFleur, who has a refreshingly direct, conversational style.
Quad City DJs play that song. I wanna feel the bass drop all night long.
Johnny McGowan, Quad City DJs, and McGowan's other group, the 69 Boys, remind me of another older Florida consortium, KC and the Sunshine Band, back in the 70s. Like McGowan, Harry Casey worked as the secret force behind any number of other one-hit wonders and found Florida's dance scene receptive to his talent for simple, sunny riffs and grooves. If you think it's easy to create such arresting mindlessness, remind yourself that tons of musicians are constantly trying to come up with arrangements of a few musical notes that will stick in the craws of millions of Americans, and the fact remains that the industry yields only one or two of these pervasive hits in any given year. Unlike a lot of novelty acts, the Quad City DJs album, Get On Up and Dance, doesn't just coast on the strength of its hit single, it's packed with fun stuff. More power to them, I say.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Barbara Bogave and Tracy Tannenbaum. Research assistance from Siobhan Roth. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Cherie Gross. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Living Language, publishers of foreign language instruction programs for over 50 years, books, audio tapes, and now CD-ROM speech recognition technology. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, the king of B-movies, making over 300 low-budget films, Roger Corman helped launch the careers of many of today's film directors and stars. We'll hear from Corman, director Joe Dante, and actor Dick Miller, star of the Corman classic A Bucket of Blood. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.